Good evening. I'd like to welcome you to the Sumitomo Life LSE annual conference. This is the fifth of six annual conferences with distinguished lectures that Sumitomo Life has been providing for and with the LSE, and we're very grateful for this occasion as for the earlier occasions. This evening we have a very distinguished lecturer, Dr. Hiroshi Inozie. Dr. Inozie is the Director General of the National Center for Science Information Systems and a Professor Emeritus of Tokyo University. He's well known for two great works, one on digital communications technology and the second on road traffic control. Now, he has a long list of great honors, which I'm told I'm to be brief about so that the director can wax grateful and eloquent later. So I will just mention two that I think he's particularly proud of. One nice for us is that Dr. Inozie is one of three Japanese honorary fellows of the Royal Institution of Great Britain, but at home he holds the Order of Culture, and the Japanese Order of Culture, which he was awarded for his work on the time slot telephone interchange system. And he's agreed at the end of his lecture this evening that we take questions and participate in general conversation. So I think that I will pass the podium immediately to Dr. Inozie, who is going to give us a lecture titled Technological Innovation for the Good of Humanity, a Japanese Perspective. Dr. Inozie.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Professor Cartwright. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It is my great pleasure and honor for being invited to give a talk here at the London School of Economics, sponsored by the Sumitomo Life Science Institute, and being given the opportunity to talk to a distinguished audience like yours. The history of civilization tells us that numerous technologies have been originated from various regions of the world and have enriched human life not only in the particular region from which technologies have been originated, but also in many other regions to which technologies have been transferred and diffused, where significant improvement of original technologies has often been made. The 20th century is no exception. It is clear that during this century, telecommunication and transportation technologies has made a great stride forward in integrating almost all economic and societal activities in the world together. Not only telecommunications, but also other information technologies, notably computers, have brought human beings an enormous capability of information processing, and motion pictures and video recording have made performing arts, festivals, and other human behavior immortal for the first time in our history. Industrial robots and other labor-saving inventions, as well as emerging computer-oriented industries, have changed the industrial structure drastically. Remarkable progress in pharmaceutics and medical electronics, as well as in agriculture and food technologies, have extended life expectancy and permitted more than 5 billion people to live on the limited space of the Earth. Ultimately, technologies which have been created, transferred, and diffused and improved in the 20th century have stemmed sustained economic growth of our economy and brought substantial improvement in the quality of life throughout the world. However, it should also be admitted that the century has been more war-ridden than any other in history. Two world wars and a number of hostilities, large and small, have wreaked havoc on the peoples in almost all corners of the world. atomic bombs and other weapons of mass destruction were wantonly released, killing great number of combatants and even greater numbers still of civilians. No such atrocities and follies should be repeated again in the next century. Technologies from now on will not be socially acceptable unless it is squarely geared to prosperity and happiness of mankind. With less than 5 years to go before the present century will have run its course, I believe that this is the right time to assess positive and negative impacts which have been brought about by technological innovation, to face up to reality and draw lessons from our experiences, and to formulate our vision toward the 21st century in promoting and directing technological innovation for the good of humanity. To this end, I also believe that it is crucial to better understand the process of technological innovation, to set targets and to motivate and mobilize as much talented people as possible to engage in various phases of the process. Ladies and gentlemen, it will not be too much of an exaggeration to say that the current political upheaval in the CIS and East European countries have been caused by the failure of their former leaders to take the tremendous impact of technological innovation for what it really is. In the first place, they failed to recognize that technological innovation is a primary engine of sustained economic growth, and in the process allowed devastating economic privations to be visited upon them. In the second place, they were at a complete loss to cope with the fact that controlling information is now virtually impossible, as technological innovation has by now made information services via telecommunication and other media readily accessible across national boundaries. They could no longer hide the dire realities of their terminal economic malaise from the eyes of their public. The particular brand of ideology that obfuscated the course of world political and economic affairs for 80 long years has burned itself out none too quickly. But it is quite symbolic that the collapse has been triggered by technological innovation, as is poignantly implied by the disappearance of the hammer and sickle, which can be belatedly be taken to have stood for an industry on the wane. Technological innovation will continue to force political and economic cartographers to drastically revise the world atlas. By the time the dramatic process of industrial restructuring currently underway has run its course, with far-reaching consequences that will pale even the great industrial revolution into insignificance, those developing countries that learn to take technological innovation for what it really is will have moved up to the rank of advanced countries, while those advanced countries that fail to do so will find their once advanced status no longer eligible for the newly defined sense of advancement. The market integration in Europe, centered around the European communities, will proceed involving the former Eastern Bloc of countries in its continuing process of evolution. It is worth noting in such a process how the wide technological and economic gaps that divide the countries concerned are going to be filled and evened out, and how their potential but varying capabilities for technological innovation are going to be productively integrated. The region surrounding Japan will likely continue to register remarkable economic growth driven chiefly by the dynamic Asian economies. Despite all the uncertainties associated with China, the East Asian region in not too distant future, will come to have significant economic and technological resources. The magnitude of problems that the United States has to face up to should not obscure the stark reality of its gigantic economic and technological power. The NAFTA involving Canada and Mexico will help revitalize the regional economy, and provided that Central and South American countries are economically and politically stabilized, the Americas will have a bright future to look forward to. Viewed in this perspective, it seems inevitable that the world will be divided into three major economic regions, namely Europe, the Americas, and East Asia. It should not be forgotten, however, that outside of the three regions, there still are hundreds of millions of people living in poverty and hunger, with standards of living deplorably inferior to those living in the three regions. The triplex has a heavy neighborly obligation, has a heavy neighborly obligation to contribute to improving their quality of life and assisting their economic growth, which is indispensable to ensuring political stability of the whole world. The question is whether the tripolarized regional economic blocks will become mutually exclusive and thereby intensify confrontation and conflict while maintaining mutually open systems and give full play to the spirit of reciprocity and compromise, not only for their own benefits, but also for the good of the whole world. The steadily proceeding and indisputably growing trend toward global interdependence should be taken as an eloquent demonstration that, over the long term, confrontation and conflict will become no more than a vestige from the past. Over the short term, however, it is still within the realm of possibility for a limited international dispute, typically over trade frictions, to escalate into a direct confrontation involving entire regional economic blocs. To the extent trade imbalances are purportedly caused by technological differentials, there are dangerous signs these days of a growing trend to try to hold and enclose as an exclusive tool for confrontation and conflict the result of technological innovation, thus should be treated as a common heritage of mankind. The history of industrialized nations that have been in the vanguard of the modern civilization has been at least in part one of hostilities repeating themselves true to the logic of confrontation. Even as these nations are trying now, for the first time in their history, to reconcile and cooperate together, the logic of confrontation dies hard and may assert itself again, not on the international level any longer, but on the escalated level of inter-regional economic blocs. The particular school of ideology on which the global structure of confrontation has been predicated for 80 long years is now at its terminal stage. Now that the groundwork logic of confrontation and conflict in the name of the proletarian dictatorship has become vacuous, what philosophy, if any, is there to fill the vacuum? Will it be the cruel logic of confrontation, again, deriving from Cartesian dualism, or will benign oriental pluralism in the spirit of reciprocity and concession shake off its veil of modesty and claim Occidental attention and recognition? Precisely because technological innovation tended to be regarded these days as a tool for confrontation and conflict rather than for coexistence and prosperity, technologists like myself are very much concerned about this as yet unanswered question. The unanswered question poses a formidable challenge to the Japanese and their status as a technological superpower and calls for radical changes in their traditional modular understanding. Living as they did in the past in a zero-sum society in complete isolation from the outside world, the people acquire the wisdom of reciprocity and compromise as a practical way of getting a measure of satisfaction in achieving one's end without hurting or penalizing the others. Even in the present-day business context of severe and excessive competition, winning side would usually not to go so far as to drive their rivals over the brink of bankruptcy, but prefer to leave them some room for surviving the lost contest. Please note, however, that the others and their rivals here were and are limited to Japanese individuals and Japanese enterprises. Centuries ago, whatever lay over the horizon and across the sea was simply beyond the ken of people living in a small island country. As was so literally expressed in the Shinto purification prayer called the Oharai no Norito, sins and impurities were to be washed away into the waters, and nobody even dreamt of the others who might be on the receiving end of drifting sins and impurities on the other end of the ocean. Had such a thought crossed their mind at all, they would not have had a linguistic term even remotely related to the others, so alien and far away. If the Japanese repine at their treatment as the odd man out of the increasingly borderless international community today, it is due above all else, to their failure to outgrow this ancient distinction between related others on the inside, who are far called Japanese, and unrelated others on the outside, who are called foreigners. It is only when the Japanese people have broken their way out of this ghost of a spell and have learned to look at all peoples of the world indiscriminately as a related others, that their spirit of reciprocity and compromise will attain enough universality to count possibly as a new global code of behavior. Only then will the power of technological innovation begin to make genuinely worthwhile contribution to a brave new world. How then can Japan best contribute to the rest of the world? One way is to make widely known and available for use elsewhere in the world the lesson of modernization that the Japanese have learned the hard way in the last 100 years, along with the national virtue of industriousness that has steadily helped them along its process. Scared of possible colonization by Western imperialist powers, the Japanese, in the wake of the Meiji Restoration, toiled and molded to consolidate their industrial base and built up their armed forces at an unavoidable cost of independence. Having tasted the luxury of victory in the last Japanese war, however, Japan committed the fatal error of joining the imperialist camp and inflicted terrible damages on its neighboring nations as it tumbled down the path of self-destruction. The alternating spells of glory and misery over the years should serve as a powerful lesson to any nation intent on military build-up as a viable means of settling its international dispute. Following the collapse of Japanese militarism in 1945, the nation was forced to make a complete transition from military to civilian industries almost overnight. It was a painful task, full of hardships, But Japan had no alternative. Immediately after the war, producers were turning out farming tools and items like pots and pans in piecemeal fashion, and workers were having a difficult time making ends meet. Eventually, Japan enacted a new constitution by which it renounced forever the use of force as a means of settling international disputes. Japan prayed that apart from a small force necessary for self-defense, it would never possess any more land, sea, or air fighting power. Moreover, the country decided that it would not export any weapons or military technology at all, so it became practically impossible for military-related industries to survive. The sole objective of such industries is to develop and produce weapons of outstanding capability. Even if the cost rises to several times more than the initial estimate, for example, the military will still buy the product as long as it possesses superior performance. Companies might engage in fierce bargaining before they land an order, but after that, the principle of competition does not function at all. Engineers get plenty of research and development fund, and many managers know that their profits are guaranteed. In civilian industries, however, companies have to take responsibility for everything from market surveys, research and development, and production to sales, and they have to achieve price performance ratios that outstrip others in the market. Engineers have to be content with limited R&D funds, and the profits are far from guaranteed for managers. Japanese companies, which staked their survival on a total transformation from the easygoing military sector to the tough civilian sector, have managed not only to improve their price performance ratios, but also to gain a high degree of consumer satisfaction by adopting strict control measures, quality control measures, and by turning out consumer-friendly products through their meticulous market surveys, and thereby acquired excellent international competitiveness. In other words, a military defeat turned into economic triumph. The achievement of this kind of success requires not only a drastic change in management philosophy, but also the influx of a large number of talented engineers, the standard bearers of technological innovation. During the war, the Japanese military put a lot of effort in technological development in three areas in particular: military aircraft, optical weapons, and electronic weapons. The most outstanding engineers were concentrated in these three areas. When it came time to switch to civilian industries, military aircraft engineers went over to automobiles, optical weapon engineers turned to cameras, and electronic weapon engineers moved into consumer electronics and telecommunications, where they set about implementing technological innovation at a fever pace. As a result, Japan has managed to become especially strong internationally in the three areas: automobiles, cameras, and electronics. The path taken by these engineers was certainly not free of hurdles, but they made honest effort in searching for the right course. Japanese products today, including specialized items like electronic microscopes, fish detectors, industrial robots, and facsimile machines, as well as more general exports like automobiles, optical cameras, super large-scale integrated circuits, television cameras, and video cassette recorders, now dominate the world. In many cases, their route goes back to wartime technology. Despite an uphill battle, the many technological breakthroughs that were achieved spread confidence among Japanese engineers and managers, and corporate spending on R&D and capital investment increased year by year. The government also supported technological innovation by subsidizing research and development spending, extending long-term loans at low interest rates, and providing tax incentives. And the drastic enhancement of engineering education at universities and colleges supported and fueled the country's rapid expanding industry by turning out a large number of engineers. In this way, the country as a whole got out and pushed to help the massive drive toward the civilian technological revolution. Even though the Cold War has drawn to a close, regional conflicts are intensifying at an awful pace. A number of countries, developing nations, as well as the military powers of the West, are exporting weapons to these regions on a frightening scale. To restrain this behavior, which is akin to trading in death, it is necessary to increase the international competitiveness of civilian industries in these countries so that they can acquire foreign currency on the civilian market. Military powers that refuse to wake up from the illusion of glory in war suffer from a deep-rooted disease that welds the military and industry together. As long as the course of this illness is not cut off, military-related industries will continue to play as major leaguers, and civilian industries remain stuck in the minors. In Japan, the civilian industries have moved up to the majors, which means that without tough competitors, their product will continue to be successful on the international market, and the trade imbalance will keep on swelling. It is largely to their credit, too, that the commonly accepted idea of military over civilian technology has been virtually replaced by the converse conception. The Japanese has developed civilian high-tech products that contribute to the world economic growth and make military superpowers vulnerably dependent on the state-of-the-art civilian supplies. Transistorized radio and television set, home videotape recorders, and other products commercialized under Japanese leadership have spread to every corner of the world, facilitated exchange of information across national borders, and played a decisive role in the world process of democratization. These products of technological innovation are rightly known today as messengers of freedom. Such a track record may well serve as a precious lesson for the CIS and East European nations, as well as the Western military powers faced with the hard realities of drastic arms reduction. Should Japan succeed by persuasion in bringing about a change of heart in the leadership of the countries concerned, it would win recognition across the world for an act of genuine international contribution. Ladies and gentlemen, as shown in the figure in my text, technological innovation is a highly complex process that consists of a number of phases, such as basic research, application research, development design, production marketing, distribution, and consumption, which are coupled very closely with each other through a number of feed-forward and feedback links. In order that an innovation be accomplished successfully, two major aspects seem to be indispensable. First, as a necessary condition, something new should be introduced to one or more of these phases. Second, in response to the introduction of something new, the whole process should dynamically adjust itself through feed-forward and feedback links to attain better results. This is the sufficient condition. basic research often played a crucial role to fulfill the necessary condition. The invention of annealing in the mid-19th century by A.W. von Hofmann and others is a good example. Following up this basic research results, German chemical industries did extensive application research and development and thereby established an outstanding process technology and manufactured not only synthetic dyes, but also a number of other products, including medicine and explosives. They were also instrumental in marketing and distribution, so that the embargo at the time of World War I caused the chaos around the world. Clearly, their effort in filling the sufficient condition brought the remarkable process success. Basic research by Badin, Bratin, and Shockley in the mid-20th century found the principle of transistors. A great deal of application research and development, as well as a remarkable effort in design, production, and marketing that followed in the United States and elsewhere, changed the whole picture of information technology, product, and services. Notably, the integrated circuitry, which is the outcome of this innovation process, brought digital computers, integrated service digital networks, and other important systems and services as practical existence. These are the good examples in which innovation process was accomplished mainly through feed-forward links starting from upstream to downstream. However, basic research is not the only necessary condition for successful innovation. Production technology is another. Mass production system invented by Henry Ford in early 20th century turned automobiles, which until then were luxuries for riches and aristocrats, into daily necessities for general public. More recently, Japanese electronic manufacturers turned the videotape recorders, which used to be expensive professional machines for broadcasters, into consumer products for every home. Likewise, industrial robots drastically improved productivity of manufacturing, and quality control technology significantly improved the reliability of products. In either of these cases, in response to the introduction of new concept of production, the whole process of innovation was adaptively changed so as to take full advantage of this introduction. A simple example is that quality control for integrated circuitry called for extensive basic research on physics of failure, and the result of which was then fed into application research and development to revolutionize processing of materials and fabrication of devices. This may be a good example for a successful functioning of innovation process by means of feedback links from downstream to upstream. In reality, both feedforward and feedback links are to function properly for successful innovation. A result of basic research should be followed up by extensive application research and development to provide a prototype. Based upon this prototype, strenuous design and production effort are required to bring end product into existence while taking into account of views on marketing and distribution and by reflecting consumers' preferences. In response to the reaction obtained through marketing, distribution, and consumption, major changes will have to be made in design and production. Application research and development and even basic research may need to respond to the request from design and production. Creativity is required to bring something new and useful in each of these phases and in responding dynamically to the changes brought by each of the feed-forward and feedback links. In other words, successful innovation needs the participation of creative people having diversified perspectives, background, and skills. Technological innovation cannot be accomplished successfully without the full-fledged participation of creative people in all phases of their integrated whole. To make such participation possible, the implication of technological innovation on economic, social, and cultural development should be thoroughly understood so as to strongly motivate creative people to engage in this activity. Once motivated, creative people may choose a specific phase or phases of innovation in accordance with their enthusiasm and background. They may wish to participate in either basic research, application research, development, design, production, marketing, or distribution, or even in customer interfacing. Some of them may be interested in exerting their creativity for the coordination and management of the whole process, if motivated to do so. Motivation for technological innovation may be different, reflecting socio-economic environment of countries and regions. However, so far as industrialized part of the world is concerned, two major terms seem to be outstanding, namely promotion of positive adjustment for industrial structure and improvement in quality of life. The rapid technological progress of high technology is exerting an intensive impact on the industrial structure, helping to improve productivity remarkably in existing industrial fields, creating new industries such as computer, telecommunication, robotics, and developing information-oriented service industries. This trend will accelerate in the future, and computerization and software intensiveness will cause remarkable changes in systems and services. The dependence of systems on devices and that of devices on materials will increase. The change in the industrial structure is inevitable. However, it must be accomplished while maintaining sustained economic growth and without involving negative social effects, including unemployment. For this reason, positive structural adjustment is an urgent matter, especially for industrialized countries in the world. For example, Japan is now undertaking an enormous task of accomplishing comprehensive structural adjustment of her economy. Her immediate motive is to correct the huge trade imbalances which still exist in spite of her efforts to date. Japan's long-term, long-range objective will be to construct a better future in response to the cost of development of high technology. To correct the trade imbalance, above all, restraints on export is necessary. To that end, it is necessary to shift the industrial and trade structures from the conventional pathway of low profit and high volume sales to high profit and small volume sales. This requires a drastic change in Japanese mind because the practice of low profit and high volume sales has been regarded traditionally as virtuous for consumers. In addition, price competition has been inevitable because Japanese products have been mainly the fruit of application research. In order to shift from this to the practice of high profit and small volume sales, enhancement of basic research and promotion of originality in science and technology is absolutely indispensable to be able to come up with high value added products capable of leading the international market price by virtue of their unparalleled performance. The newly industrialized economies in the Asia-Pacific region share similar problems with Japan, one of the high technology areas which is well suited to the new industrial economies is software technology. It is a highly sophisticated technology that requires a very large number of well-educated workforce. It is knowledge-intensive and labor-intensive, but not quite capital-intensive. Because of Confucian tradition, the newly industrialized economies in this area esteem education, but have not always been able to provide sufficient job opportunities for their highly educated people. While the introduction of computer hardware plants require heavy capital investment and will do little to augment employment, software production could create a vast number of jobs and for educated people with much less capital investment. All these background may suggest the software is the right technology for the newly industrialized economies in the Asia-Pacific region. Considering that the mushrooming demand of software products can only be met by an international division of labor, the full-fledged participation of creative people in the newly industrialized economies will significantly contribute to overcome the so-called worldwide software crisis. Implication of high technology for industrial structure, if correctly understood, may hasten the arrival of the developing countries among the ranks of the developed. And if the developed countries do not correctly perceive the possibilities, they may join the ranks of the underdeveloped. The rapid development of industrial economies based on the fast progress of technological innovation has resulted in consumption of large amount of energy and raw materials and mass production and consumption of huge quantities of products, which led to various environmental problems such as air pollution, water pollution, and excessive waste of materials. Such problems, including a warming of the earth caused by carbon dioxide, destruction of the ozone layer by fluorocarbons, acid rain, and radioactive pollution from an accident of nuclear plants. Contrary to economic prosperity, the living environment of the world has deteriorated. To solve these environmental problems, concerted effort in technological innovation are necessary to develop alternative sources of energy and new materials to prevent pollution by appropriate means, including desulfurization, and to improve the safety of nuclear energy. At times, this type of technological innovation tended to be acknowledged as an obligation to meet regulations. However, solving environmental problems provide new opportunities for technology and industry. Japan, for example, has strengthened the international competitiveness of automobiles made in Japan by adhering to the strict air pollution regulation, which called for the development of clean automotive engines. If appropriate and effective regulation were implemented in the future, on the basis of sufficient scientific evidence, solution of environmental problems on a global scale would largely contribute not only to the improvement of our living environment, but also to the strengthening of the capabilities of technology. The fast development of information and communication technology created sophisticated services based on telecommunication computers. Various socio-economic activities, which were carried out independently before, are now closely integrated, despite physical separation, through increasing exchange of information. Large amounts of information are now transmitted, processed, and utilized. Network systems using communication satellite and optical fiber cables have become popular and are in use on global scale. Yet, on the other hand, vulnerability issues in computerized society have arisen, such as infringement of privacy and concerns on reliability and safety of services. Further technological innovation is necessary in regard to access control to databases, maintenance of integrity of information, improving software reliability, establishment of confidentiality of communication, including the use of cryptography and the countermeasures for accident. While the world population is continuously growing, In contrast to the prosperity of industrialized countries, many people in the developing areas are still suffering from poverty and starvation. Children are the most valuable asset of mankind. If we give them a warm welcome and provide sufficient nourishment, good living environment, and good education, they would be able to create a better future. Consequently, technological innovation must be directed on a full scale to achieve industrial progress, economic development, and an increase of food production. Prosperity, however, is not the ultimate goal of mankind. What everyone is looking for is a meaningful life and happiness. When the suicide rate is used to measure the degree of unhappiness, the fact that suicide rate in industrialized countries, including Japan, is extremely higher than that in developing countries, reveals a great irony. Technological innovation of today are excessively economy-oriented and efficiency-oriented. Cultural satisfaction, which is a source of meaningful life and happiness, is sometimes forgotten. However, when considering the cultural benefit brought by technology throughout our history, the role to be played by technology today is stronger by far compared to that in the past. For example, computer technology has opened new dimensions that have enabled composers and musicians to create outstanding music using new methods of expression. Furthermore, information technology has made it possible to create completely new artificial environment through the use of supercomputers and computer graphics, providing opportunities to experience unique sensation. This will greatly help us to expand our sensitivity and feelings, and thereby to create new culture. Ladies and gentlemen, what I have said is only a small fraction of many diverse issues relative to the orientation of technological innovation toward the good of humanity. Clearly, the most important foundation to this end is human resources development. For younger generations, education for all levels should be drastically reformed and intensified. In the light of convergence of natural sciences with social sciences and humanities, interdisciplinary education should be enhanced also. And in view of the quick obsolescence of knowledge on the one hand and the rapid aging society on the other, continuing education should be provided extensively. In an era when people can look forward to a lifespan of 8 years, it is important to maintain the fresh perception and curiosity of youth throughout our lives so as to make our tomorrow more creative than ever. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much for a fine lecture on a broad topic of the use of technology for the good of humanity. Are there comments, questions? Yes, please.
My name is Patrick.
Yes. Thank you very much, Dr. Pervit. I'm very happy to be able to talk with you since I last met you more than 7-8 years ago. But we are very close colleagues each other at the OECD, especially in CSTP Science and Technological Policy Committee. And we discussed at that time in length about this and a free ride on basic research by Japanese industry and so forth. So I don't want to repeat this again. But I would think that right after the war, when our country was devastated, then the primary motive of our country was to reconstruct our economy. And engineers looking around the world, and they found that there are quite a few results of basic research, which is not at all, you know, commercialized. And and of course, if there is nothing of that sort, then I think we are obliged to start everything from basic research. But at that time, there were such results of basic research, which is not yet commercialized. And so for the purpose of economic reconstruction, the Japanese engineers jumped up to such a basic result and tried to commercialize that. And that helped our economy to build up. And also, I think it helped to some extent the economic growth of the world. But now I would think that the sea is completely different. We have, since the last 10 years or 15 years, our country is enjoying a sort of prosperity which we never had before. And on the other hand, there is not much basic research in us, which we do not have. We are almost in the forefront, or almost all the high technology areas. So we needed to put more effort in basic research. And that has been said for over 20 years, but what was the realization of that was taking place about, to my mind, 7-8 years ago. But especially when the government, our government issued a guidelines for science and technology policy 2 years ago, 3 years ago, I think. That is 1992. Almost all the government sectors, I think, decided to put a lot more emphasis in basic research. And for instance, in the budget amendment in 1993, which amounted to, I just forgot to figure, 2 or 3 trillion yen, universities got very fast local area networks all of a sudden in that area. Before that, only one local area networks were installed in one university per year. But all of a sudden in that year, we had all the national universities installed with FDD runs, and more than 200 private universities, the same thing. And now my organization is obliged to connect them each other, which is something like a super journal here, which has been promoted by Dr. Brian Perry and others. So, and also the spending in basic research is increased at an annual rate of 7 to 8% per year. So I think we still have financial difficulties because our financial deficit is keep on increasing. But nevertheless, we believe that our basic research will be intensified in much higher pace than it was before 10, 15 years ago.
Yes, please.
Way, what you're saying about the government. my first question is, therefore, do you think that the technological advance or lead that you say Japan has in high technology is going to slow down in future as a result of the bursting of the bubble economy and the fact that Japanese companies can't really afford to finance to the same degree both the life employment system and the very high spending on research and development? That's the first question. The second one is relates to what you were saying about the division of the world into three blocks. What do you think, how is this affected by the tendency of Japanese companies like companies in Europe or America to make corporate alliances to collaborate on research and development because neither party can afford to pay the accelerating costs and the accelerating obsolescence of technology? Doesn't this mean also that since both the parties to such a strategic alliance are going to have an interest in making as much money out of it as possible, that they are not going to be likely to make the results of their research available freely to the poor and the developing?
Well, the first question, I think, need a very long time to answer fully. But I think that not only Japan, but almost all the industrial countries are facing the same problem of high cost of high technology. But nevertheless, we need to spend that much money for the economic growth and for the better future. So we are, I think it is, there is no way out. And even in the present situation of economic recession, if you average out all the industries, all the industrial areas, probably in the United States, UK, and Japan, the corporate spending in R&D is getting smaller than before. But if you look at the specific high technology areas, still their investment is going is increasing. So this is a clear indication that we are facing a tremendous industrial revolution, a new industrial revolution, and which I think should be, if we are we don't face squarely to that, then we will get into trouble. So this is a very hard time, but nevertheless we must keep on investing in high technologies to keep our economy going, going, and to reduce unemployment issues. And the second question is that the corporate alliances between three industrial blocks. I think this has been already taken place. For instance, everybody now talks about the system integration, and actually the main framers, you know, main computer manufacturers, are now saying that we are now no longer main framers, we are system integrators. And if you look at their performances, then they will look around the world and buy the cheapest and most and best equipment from all part of the world and put together. And because of that, this system integration business is becoming very, very profitable. So that one of the top executives of system integrators wanted to become a U.S. president at the time of last election. So they are having a tremendous power. And my American friends say that one of those system integrators can well buy the whole Harvard University endowment at once. So this system orientation is taking place all over the world, involving not only the industrial world, but also the newly industrial economies. So if you look at the computer components or computer subsystems, you find in the back it's made in China, made in Hong Kong, made in Indonesia, and so forth. So actually, we are already so intertwined each other. And I think this kind of alliance would continue, regardless to whether our government would think over the, you know, over some our technologies, I think. It is really a fastly changing world of corporate alliances.
Yes, please.
Yes. Technological innovation does two things. It creates new products, extra time on that account, but it also enables old products to be done, to be produced more efficiently. Could you envisage a scenario in which the gain
well, always we must consider the cost and benefit. And I think in that sense, we want to consider the cost and benefit issues in a technological innovation. But at the same time, there are the cost of developing high technologies will be recovered by the deflection of those technologies to the existing traditional technologies. For instance, if you count the of in iron steel industry by means of computer technologies, then you will find that no iron steel industry could exist in this world without the use of computers. So the computer technology, the cost of computer developing computer technologies, even if it is very high, it is not only born by computer industries, but was also born by the industries, all sort of industry, traditional or new, which uses computers. So I think this is generic features of the high technologies. So I'm not an economist, so you are much better. Knowledgeable about this cost of performance analysis, but it should be viewed in a broad, by a broad scope covering all sectors of manufacturing and services.
Yes, please.
International division of labor in an area in which obviously everybody in every nation is tremendously interested. And if the developing as well as the developed world is focused on this very area of high technology, would it not be the case that it will become a focal point of competition, confrontation, and in a sense warfare, rather than harmonious the harmonious division of labor?
If we look at the such new recent development like internet, that covers the whole world, and more than 30,000 networks are involved in that, interconnected, and about 40 million people are using it. And that is not only covering the advanced, developed part of the world, but it's covering developing part of the world very, very quickly. And now I think the software houses are using this sort of network very quickly to have a sort of the software development away from the offices. And that is now extended not only from the city to the local areas, but also now it is crossing national boundaries. I understand that many Indians or the Taiwanese are now developing software on behalf of US and European countries and some Japanese companies. So that is already, this international distribution labor is taking place. And so that is already sort of ongoing, you know, activities. And that will be intensified because the software production still needs a tremendous human power brain. The secondary, especially if you develop a application software, you need to develop a local software houses, local software engineers to take full account of the local needs. So, and that local need is spreading all over the world, not only developing part, but also developed part, but also developing part of the world. I think that this new wave is spreading so rapidly, so that it is really frightening in some sense. And of course, it frightened us because this network has not much security and reliability measures. But nevertheless, they are using it, and the usage is increasing day by day. So this is one of the good examples of that whether we like it or not, international division of labor is taking place in the marketplace, especially.
Yes, please.
Well, I would say that software cannot stand alone. You need hardware. Software needs hardware, to be useful. So some people say that this is a rain tree analogy. You have there are the sort of trees in the United States, especially in Florida, that hangs on the huge trees, and that tree looks better in some season, in part of the season, but and the main tree itself is, you know, is not as good, looks as, not as good as like that, but still this rain tree can only survive if the main tree is standing there. So that is very similar to the software issue. Software can never stand by itself. They need a very sound, widespread and quick development of hardware technology and system technology. So in that sense, I think that what the importance is software. In this, for software industries, the hardware development is indispensable. And that, I think, generally applies to the service industries. You need the primary and secondary industry to be very, very strong to have tertiary industries standing on its feet. So it is, again, it's very much intermingled activity. So, like agricultural industry, and everybody thinks that agricultural industry is a sort of backward industries. But because the agricultural industry is strong, so we can eat everybody every day and work. So, so it is the industrial structure is multi-layered. And software industry is a part of the service industry, which is standing on the top. But if your lower layers is not sound, then this software industry or service industry cannot really survive.
I thought I'd seen another hand over here. Is that not? Yes, please.
Yes, my name is Kai Brown, Sharp Forest in Europe. Professor Inese, one of the main points you were making throughout the talk, the early parts of your talk anyhow, was that for the betterment of mankind and for the higher standard of living of everybody, that we should move to an era of much greater interdependence of people. And I wondered, therefore, to take a point you raised about internet and such networks, how you actually see this phenomenon. Of course, your own technology has led to the success of such networks, but there are great problems with internet, World Wide Web, and such things, the security you have actually mentioned. But also, one of the main problems will be to stop people, or not stop, but to lead to a situation where people won't travel as much or meet people as much. I mean, I've already got people in my laboratory who say, well, we form friendships all over through internet, and I'll never see them. I wonder how you actually see that
development. Yes. Well, the internet is, I think, is a marvelous thing in the sense that we can talk almost immediately to each other on a global scale. But it is also a sort of annoying thing. If you are a very busy person, and people but still people are just keep on sending your emails. So I was told that some of the American executives has 3 or 4 secretaries to screen out of emails every day. So if you need more information, then email is a marvelous thing. But if you don't need too much information, then the internet is a very premature machine or system. So I think if somebody will invent a sort of software that can browsing through emails and give you only a few emails a day, then you have enough time to think. But otherwise, you have to spend almost all your time reading those junk mails. So this is the society we are facing. And what was your question? So I would think that internet and all sorts of the communication facilities are wisely used by people, then this will, I think, promote their creativity, and they would also have a more closer collaboration with their colleagues. And also, when the telephone systems has been installed very rapidly in the developed part of the world, many people thought that this will reduce the physical transportation, but in actuality, they increase air transportation, especially because in the past, before, nobody had any means of knowing each other across geographical distances. But by means of the telephone, they got to know to talk to each other, Then they wanted to see each other or to kiss each other, I would say. But anyway, the sort of personal communication. So there is some complementary features in transportation and communication, but there are also the multiplication features of those two things. And I think that those two factors will work each other. And in that process, I think people would learn to make use of those new technologies for much better purposes. But at this moment, I think internet is creating a lot of confusion in the world. Thank you.
I think it's time that we close now. And could we close by again thanking Dr. Inozi for important thoughts and Sumitomo Life for arranging the conference for us?
Thank you very much.